We meet again in the Life Divine. Now in the final chapter, chapter 28, The Divine Life. Sri Aurobindo has recently described the power, the illumination of the Gnostic individual living within the context of a Gnostic community. And this Gnostic life would have an impact even on the life of the ignorant, such that it would bring into harmony the elements in the living context, drawing the elements of ignorance upwards towards light, away from division, towards a harmonic composition. So he continues this idea this evening for quite a number of pages, leading us to look at the authentic nature of our own being, how it expresses itself in the collective, and to what end it directs itself. What is the evolutionary destiny of the awakened soul living in an awakening community? What impact does it have on the world? Personal transformation leading to social transformation, leading to global transformation, and the gladdening of all existence, the revelation of what the true significance of existence is. So along the way, he will look at various types of historical analysis, vis-a-vis Toynbee, etc. So it'll be fun. He continues here. If this is our evolutionary destiny, it remains for us to see where we stand at this juncture in the evolutionary progression, a progression which has been cyclic or spiral rather than in a straight line, or has at least journeyed in a very zigzag swinging curve of advance, and what prospect there is of any turn towards a decisive step in the near or measurable future. So the idea that evolutionary advance is not linear, you can't draw a straight line, it is often spiraling, as an apt image once presented to us had it. As you climb the mountain, and it's conical, on one side there's a forest, and on the other side, the bare rock. Whenever you're passing through the forest, you can't see the peak. You forget where you are, you're not thinking of any advance anymore, you're simply trying to survive from moment to moment. But on the other side, when you get around, and you can see the rock face, you can look up and see, there's the destination. And so slowly you make these circular movements around and around, but they become tighter and tighter, shorter and shorter, and eventually you do arrive at the peak. And the idea of a linear advance is, of course, something that early philosophers of history talked about. But Giambattista Vico, back in the 18th century, talked about this spiraling curve of advance. Yes, there is an advance, but it seems to retreat back on itself. But then there's another advance, another move upward, and you find yourself a level higher. What seemed to be a prelude to an utter disaster found a way to open to a greater future. And so we go. In our human aspiration towards a personal perfection and the perfection of the life of the race, the elements of the future evolution are foreshadowed and striven after, but in a confusion of half-enlightened knowledge. There is a discord between the necessary elements, an opposing emphasis, a profusion of rudimentary, unsatisfying, and ill-accorded solutions. these sway between the three principal preoccupations of our idealism: the complete single development of the human being in himself, the perfectibility of the individual; a full development of the collective being, the perfectibility of society; and more pragmatically restricted, the perfect or best possible relations of individual with individual and society, and of community with community. An exclusive or dominant emphasis is laid sometimes on the individual, sometimes on the collectivity or society, sometimes on a right and balanced relation between the individual and the collective human whole. One idea holds up the growing life, freedom, or perfection of the individual. One idea holds up the growing life, freedom, or perfection of the human individual as the true object of our existence, whether the ideal be merely a free self-expression of the personal being or a self-governed whole of complete mind, fine and ample life and perfect body, or a spiritual perfection and liberation. In this view, society is there only as a field of activity and growth for the individual man, and serves best its function when it gives as far as possible a wide room, ample means, a sufficient freedom or guidance of development to his thought, his action, his growth, his possibility of fullness of being. An opposite idea gives the collective life the first or the sole importance. The existence, the growth of the race is all. The individual has to live for the society or for mankind, or even he is only a cell of the society. He has no other use or purpose of birth, no other meaning of his presence in nature, no other function. Or it is held that the nation, the society, the community is a collective being, revealing its soul in its culture, power of life, ideals, institutions, all its ways of self-expression. The individual life has to cast itself in that mold of culture, serve that power of life, consent only to exist as an instrument for the maintenance and efficiency of the collective existence. In another idea, the perfection of man lies in his ethical and social relations with other men. He is a social being and has to live for society, for others, for his utility to the race. The society also is there for the service of all, to give them their right relation, education, training, economic opportunity, right frame of life. In the ancient cultures, the greatest emphasis was laid on the community and the fitting of the individual into the community. But also, there grew up an idea of the perfected individual. In ancient India, it was the idea of the spiritual individual that was dominant. But the society was of extreme importance because in it and under its molding influence, the individual had to pass first through the social status of the physical, vital, mental being with his satisfaction of interest, desire, pursuit of knowledge, and right living before he could reach fitness for a truer self-realization and a free spiritual existence. The four aims of life, you remember. In recent times, the whole stress has passed to the life of the race, to a search for the perfect society, and latterly, to a concentration on the right organization and scientific mechanization of the life of mankind as a whole. The individual now tends more to be regarded only as a member of the collectivity, a unit of the race whose existence must be subordinated to the common aims and total interest of the organized society, and much less, or not at all, as a mental or spiritual being with his own right and power of existence. This tendency has not yet reached its acme everywhere, but everywhere it is rapidly increasing and heading towards dominance. Now, Sri Aurobindo is writing again, 1939, roughly, when this argument, which still echoes in the halls of political science today, between socialism and capitalism was at its peak. The argument has shifted in tone, and the terms are different now. But Sri Aurobindo's drawing our attention to the individual, the collective, and the interrelationship between the two. He won't be caught in this, and about a paragraph, he begins to set the context or to reframe the argument on the right basis. Thus, in the vicissitudes of human thought, on one side, the individual is moved or invited to discover and pursue his own self-affirmation, his own development of mind and life and body, his own spiritual perfection. On the other, he is called on to efface and subordinate himself and to accept the ideas, ideals, will, instincts, interests of the community as his own. He is moved by nature to live for himself and by something deep within him to affirm his individuality. He is called upon by society and by a certain mental idealism to live for humanity, for the greater good of the community. The principle of self and its interest is met and opposed by the principle of altruism. The state erects its godhead and demands his obedience, submission, subordination, self-immolation. The individual has to affirm against this exorbitant claim the rights of his ideals, his ideas, his personality, his conscience. It is evident that all this conflict of standards is a groping of the mental ignorance of man, seeking to find its way and grasping different sides of the truth, but unable by its want of integrality and knowledge to harmonize them together. A unifying and harmonizing knowledge can alone find the way. But that knowledge belongs to a deeper principle of our being to which oneness and integrality are native. It is only by finding that in ourselves that we can solve the problem of our existence and with it the problem of the true way of individual and communal living. So, he's leading us back to the spiritual solution to the problems of division in the world of human life. And here he states it. There is a reality, a truth of all existence, which is greater and more abiding than all its formations and manifestations. To find that truth and reality and live in it, achieve the most perfect manifestation and formation possible of it, must be the secret of perfection, whether of individual or communal being. To move from what is not true and real to what is your fundamental reality. We were chanting that just moments ago, Asato Ma Sadgamaya. Lead me from the unreal to the real, to Sat, the first element of Sat-Chit-Ananda, the true existence. This reality is there within each thing and gives to each of its formations its power of being and value. of being. Chit and Ananda are therefore implied. The universe is a manifestation of the reality, and there is a truth of the universal existence, a power of cosmic being, an all-self or world spirit. Remember that to manifest means to make plain, to make visible, to make it come to the front. It was always there in potency, perhaps even in actuality, but never has it been seen. So when it is seen, it is manifest. So this reality manifests itself as a universe. Humanity is a formation or manifestation of the reality in the universe, and there is a truth and self of humanity, a human spirit, a destiny of human life. So please note, Sri Aurobindo is a realist. Being is not vacuous, it's not evanescent. There is something substantive about the forms of the becoming. There is a being that enters into the becoming. There is an essence that is real behind the apparent changes and phenomena of nature, of the manifest reality, whether it is universal or whether it is reflected in society as a whole or whether it's reflected in the changes apparent in the individual. There is an essence. The community is a formation of the reality, a manifestation of the spirit of man, and there is a truth, a self, a power of the collective being. The individual is a formation of the reality, and there is a truth of the individual, an individual self, soul, or spirit that expresses itself through the individual mind, life, and body, and can express itself, too, in something that goes beyond mind, life, and body, something even that goes beyond humanity. For our humanity is not the whole of the reality or its best possible self-formation or self-expression. The reality has assumed, before man existed, an infrahuman formation and self-creation, and can assume after him or in him a suprahuman formation and self-creation. So we speak about a subliminal existence behind the apparent facade of our nature, supported itself by a psychic essence which we call the soul. Sri Aurobindo implies here that even so, in a community, in a group, in a nation, in humanity as a whole, as in the cosmos, there is a soul presence in formation, in development. In the individual, we see it come to a more rapid perfection, but it is an actual possibility, a possibility that will actuate itself in social life when we have grown into this grand harmony that he has betokened with the evolution towards the supramental, the Gnostic life. Here he said that the manifestation of this reality can continue beyond humanity or in humanity. So it is possible within humanity to make this greater linkage to a transcendent reality. The human form need not be discarded if it is willing to undergo the divine change. The individual, as spirit or being, is not confined within his humanity. He has been less than human. He can become more than human. The universe finds itself through him, even as he finds himself in the universe. but he is capable of becoming more than the universe, since he can surpass it and enter into something in himself and in it and beyond it that is absolute. He is not confined within the community. Although his mind and life are, in a way, part of the communal mind and life, there is something in him that can go beyond them. The community exists by the individual, for its mind and life and body are constituted by the mind and life and body of its composing individuals. If that were abolished or disaggregated, its own existence would be abolished or disaggregated, though some spirit or power of it might form again in other individuals. But the individual is not a mere cell of the collective existence. He would not cease to exist if separated or expelled from the collective mass. For the collectivity, the community, is not even the whole of humanity, and it is not the world. The individual can exist and find himself elsewhere in humanity or by himself in the world. If the community has a life dominating that of the individuals which constitute it, still it does not constitute their whole life. If it has its being, which it seeks to affirm, by the life of the individual also has a being of his own, which he seeks to affirm in the life of the community. But he is not tied to that. He can affirm himself in another communal life, or if he is strong enough, in a nomad existence, or in an eremite solitude where, if he cannot pursue or achieve a complete material living, he can spiritually exist and find his own reality and indwelling self of being. Eremite, from etymos, the Greek word which means the desert, so a recluse, somebody that pulls away from the society. You can, as an isolated individual, still look within and find the truth, the essence of your own being. It's not a final status, but it's a possible status. So you can see what he's driving to here. The individual is key to the universe. The individual is key to the community. I embarrass myself. The next sentence. The individual is indeed the key of the evolutionary movement. For it is the individual who finds himself, who becomes conscious of the reality. The movement of the collectivity is a largely subconscious mass movement. It has to formulate and express itself through the individuals to become conscious. Its general mass consciousness is always less evolved than the consciousness of its most developed individuals, and it progresses insofar as it accepts their impress or develops what they develop. The individual does not owe his ultimate allegiance either to the state, which is a machine, or to the community, which is a part of life and not the whole of life. His allegiance must be to the truth, the self, the spirit, the divine, which is in him and in all. Not to subordinate or lose himself in the mass, but to find and express that truth of being in himself and help the community and humanity in its seeking for its own truth and fullness of being must be his real object of existence. A light kindling other lights, a child leading children. But the extent to which the power of the individual life or the spiritual reality within it becomes operative depends on his own development. So long as he is undeveloped, he has to subordinate in many ways his undeveloped self to whatever is greater than it. As he develops, he moves towards a spiritual freedom. But this freedom is not something entirely separate from all existence. It has a solidarity with it because that too is the self, the same spirit. As he moves towards spiritual freedom, he moves also towards spiritual oneness. Unshackling yourself from ignorance, dropping the divisive nature of the ego, leads to community, to fraternity, to oneness. The spiritually realized, the liberated man, is preoccupied, says the Gita, with the good of all beings. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, verses 3 and 4. Buddha, discovering the way of nirvana, must turn back to open that way to those who are still under the delusion of their constructive instead of their real being or non-being. Vivekananda, drawn by the absolute, feels also the call of the disguised Godhead in humanity, and most the call of the fallen and the suffering, the call of the self to the self in the obscure body of the universe. So, who stands in great solidarity with that spiritual reality above, necessarily comes to feel love, compassion, oneness with all around, and seeks to lean out, to lean down, to aid, to lead, to give. For the awakened individual, the realization of his truth of being and his inner liberation and perfection must be his primary seeking. First, because that is the call of the spirit within him, but also because it is only by liberation and perfection and realization of the truth of being that man can arrive at truth of living. A perfected community also can exist only by the perfection of its individuals, and perfection can come only by the discovery and affirmation in life by each of his own spiritual being and the discovery by all of their spiritual unity and a resultant life unity. There can be no real perfection for us except by our inner self and truth of spiritual existence taking up all truth of the instrumental existence into itself and giving to it oneness, integration, harmony. As our only real freedom is the discovery and disengagement of the spiritual reality within us, so our only means of true perfection is the sovereignty and self-effectuation of the spiritual reality in all the elements of our nature. So, that real, that sat, must stand in full exhibition, in mind, in life, in body, an expression of the soul through all the instruments of nature. But that nature perfected in an individual, reaching out and touching the perfection in the neighboring individual, and in the wider community around, and in the harmony as it spills into the rest of surrounding nature. Our nature is complex, and we have to find a key to some perfect unity and fullness of its complexity. Its first evolutionary basis is the material life. Nature began with that, and man also has to begin with it. He has first to affirm his material and vital existence. But if he stops there, there can be for him no evolution. His next and greater preoccupation must be to find himself as a mental being in a material life, both individual and social, as perfected as possible. This was the direction which the Hellenic idea gave to European civilization, and the Roman reinforced or weakened it with the ideal of organized power. The cult of reason, the interpretation of life by an intellectual thought, critical, utilitarian, organizing, and constructive, the government of life by science, are the last outcome of this inspiration. But in ancient times, the higher creative and dynamic element was the pursuit of an ideal truth, good, and beauty, and the molding of mind, life, and body into perfection and harmony by this ideal. Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram. Beyond and above this preoccupation, as soon as mind is sufficiently developed, there awakes in man the spiritual preoccupation. First chapter of the Life Divine. Beyond and above this preoccupation, as soon as mind is sufficiently developed, there awakes in man the spiritual preoccupation, the discovery of a self and inmost truth of being, and the release of man's mind and life into the truth of the Spirit, its perfection by the power of the Spirit, the solidarity, unity, mutuality of all beings in the Spirit. This was the Eastern ideal, carried by Buddhism and other ancient disciplines to the coasts of Asia and Egypt, and from there poured by Christianity into Europe. But these motives, burning for a time like dim torchlights in the confusion and darkness created by the barbaric flood that had submerged the old civilizations, have been abandoned by the modern spirit, which has found another light, the light of science. What the modern spirit has sought for is the economic social ultimate, an ideal material organization of civilization and comfort, the use of reason and science and education for the generalization of a utilitarian rationality, which will make the individual a perfected social being in a perfected economic society. What remained from this spiritual ideal was, for a time, a mentalized and moralized humanitarianism, relieved of all religious coloring, and a social ethicism, which was deemed all-sufficient to take the place of a religious and individual ethic. It was so far that the race had reached when it found itself hurried forward by its own momentum into a subjective chaos and a chaos of its life in which all received values were overthrown and all firm ground seemed to disappear from its social organization, its conduct, and its culture. If you read The Ideal of Human Unity or the books that Sri Aurobindo serialized in the Arya on social philosophy, you'll find that he is likely referring here to an effort that a nation might make in the search for its soul, and instead of arriving at the soul, arrive at the discovery of its own ego, of its vitality. And just as an individual can go inside and at the first blush discover the vital being at the center of the nature, the heart, the emotions, and identify with that emotional figuring of itself, not arrive at the true soul, and live from that for a while until the energy fails, the experience leaves one disgruntled, and you recommence the search for the deeper self. That can happen in the life of a nation as well. And Sri Aurobindo here, writing in the context of what we call World War II, may be referring to these kinds of upheavals that seem to be a darkening of the human condition, but may ultimately lead to a greater light. Here, also, this idea, idealism on one side, competing with idealism on the other side, reminds us of what he said in a different context, that, and early on in his writing, that the French Revolution failed because while it gave individual freedom, it denied freedom to the whole. It gave freedom, but denied equality. The Bolshevik Revolution failed because while it gave equality, it denied freedom. It is only when that third element, fraternity, arises that you can harmonize the whole. The individual, the society, can only be unified when one touches the power of the spirit. When you live in oneness, when you live in fellow feeling with all around, then you can perfect society. So it is never the individual against the world against the individual, but the individual who wakes to the self, behind society, that can bring them together in an amplified and harmonized life that reaches out and builds itself. The individual liberated cannot remain alone. It must build a spiritual society, an awakened society, with others who feel also the power of that light. This is what Sri Aurobindo worked to establish for the 40 years that he lived in Pondicherry, in that small community that grew into the greatest ashram on the globe. And that effort continues. But our effort for the evening ends now. We'll put a bookmark there and we'll continue with the Life Divine next time. So I thought I would read a section from Savitri, which is in Book 4, the Book of Birth and Quest, Canto 4, The Quest, in which Savitri's sojourn through the world in search of he whom we know as Satyavan, he who carries truth. Comes to a quiet space, away from the busyness of the city, which we can idealize as a place that we go to inside to find harmony and to build a perfect life. Here it is. This spirit stumbling in the fields of sense, this creature bruised in the mortar of the days, could find in her broad spaces of release. Not yet was a world all occupied by care. The bosom of our mother kept for us still, her austere regions and her musing depths, her impersonal reaches lonely and inspired, and the mightinesses of her rapture haunts. Muse-lipped, she nursed her symbol mysteries and guarded for her pure-eyed sacraments the valley clefts between her breasts of joy, her mountain altars for the fires of dawn, and nuptial beaches where the ocean couched and the huge chanting of her prophet woods. Fields had she of her solitary mirth, plains hushed and happy in the embrace of light, alone with the cry of birds and hue of flowers, and wildernesses of wonder lit by her moons, and gray sear evenings kindling with the stars, and dim movement in the night's infinitude. August, exulting in her maker's eye, she felt her nearness to him in earth's breast, conversed still with the light behind the veil, still communed with eternity beyond. A few and fit inhabitants she called to share the glad communion of her peace. The breadth, the summit, were their natural home. The strong king sages, from their labor done, freed from the warrior tension of their task, came to her serene sessions in these wilds. The strife was over, the respite lay in front. Happy they lived with birds and beasts and flowers and sunlight and the rustle of the leaves, and heard the wild winds wandering in the night, mused with the stars in their mute constant ranks, and lodged in the mornings as in azure tents, and with the glory of the noons were one. Some deeper plunged, from life's external clasp, beckoned into a fiery privacy in the soul's unprofaned star-white recess, they sojourned with an ever-living bliss. A voice profound in the ecstasy and the hush, they heard, beheld, an all-revealing light. All time-made difference they overcame. The world was fibered with their own heart strings, close drawn to the heart that beats in every breast. They reached the one self in all through boundless love. Idyllic nature. And we'll continue this passage next time we meet. Thank you. Namaste. Jai Ma.